CITR FM 101.9
Vancouver.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, March 3rd, and I'm Emma Loy.
And I'm Maham Khanum. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:02 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
To start the show, we have News 101 reporters Malone Mullen and Kale Murray's report on Vancouver's drug overdose crisis.
Following that, we have News 101 reporter Josh Gabardoyan's interview with Dr. Henry on Black History Month.
Finally, we have Sydney Soldon's report on the official opening of the Trump Towers in Vancouver and the protest that erupted outside the building on Tuesday.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, students have organized a silent protest against Furlong's reinstatement as keynote speaker. A silent protest against John Furlong's involvement in the annual ZLC Millennial Scholarship Breakfast took place in front of Kerner Library on Monday. The former Vancouver Olympics CEO was removed as a speaker from the event in December. This came after a letter sent to UBC brought up allegations that he abused First Nations children during his time as a teacher at a residential school. Santa Ono later apologized to Furlong and reinstated him to speak at the event. The testimonies of Ronnie West and Richard Perry were read out to those protesting the event, which explained that West and Perry were former pupils of Furlong's who respectively witnessed and experienced verbal and physical abuse from him. Perry explained, quote, "We are talking in our native language, and we got taken to a private room, and we got hit by a leather strap," end quote. Richard Perry's sister, Myrtle Perry, also spoke at the event about her similar experience in the residential school, saying, quote, "From the experience that I went through with Immaculata Residential School, I know that these things happen," end quote. Myrtle Perry said that her message to the UBC community would be to learn more about First Nations and to give them more understanding and support. The new provincial budget will lower the student loan interest rate. The provincial government announced that the BC student loan interest rate will be reduced from 2.5% to the prime interest rate, which will be effective as of August 2017. The government plans to streamline the process of applying for student loans by introducing a fixed student contribution model. By doing so, they fulfilled one of the AMS's three main lobbying goals concerning the budget, that of making post-secondary education more affordable for students. AMS VP Kathleen Simpson said the AMS is very pleased to see the reduction in the BC student loan interest rate, which is an important first step towards greater education affordability. Student executives are working to also address the other two recommendations initially made by the AMS regarding operating grants and the UPass program. Simpson added that, quote, "Advocating for improved funding to post-secondary education remains a priority for the AMS, and we will be looking for all BC political parties to make this a priority in the May provincial elections," end quote.
In local news, the mayor of North Vancouver is calling for a rapid transit tunnel to link Vancouver to the North Shore. A $130 million upgrade to the Upper Levels Highway was recently announced to combat the chronic traffic congestion on the North Shore. However, Mayor of North Vancouver, Daryl Masato, thinks more needs to be done. He's proposing a third crossing between the North Shore and Vancouver, a rapid transit tunnel underneath Burrard Inlet. The city of North Vancouver has already approached TransLink about looking into a 3-kilometer SkyTrain tunnel under the inlet. Masato said, you could have a train leaving every 3 or 4 minutes as opposed to every 15 minutes right now. It might be something that could really encourage people to get out of their automobile instead of driving over one of the two bridges taking a SkyTrain link," end quote. The tunnel would have to run more than 70 meters below sea level at its deepest point, something that tunnel expert Dane Brock says is totally feasible with today's technology. Brock said, quote, "Tunneling methods have become so innovative to date that they are able to build very sophisticated and more challenging tunnels," end quote. In addition, construction costs would be offset somewhat by money saved in wages, fuel, and maintenance to the C-bus. Donald Trump's Suns opened their latest hotel in Vancouver on Tuesday as protesters rallied outside. Demonstrators brandished "Love Trump's Hate" and "Deport Racism" placards ahead of the opening of the Trump Tower. Trump's sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, and his daughter Tiffany attended the grand opening to the launch of the $360 million hotel and condominium development. In an interview with the Toronto Star, Eric Trump said, quote, "We've had an unbelievable past year on so many fronts as a family. We've opened so many great properties." Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson, who had lobbied for the Trump name to be removed from the tower, refused to attend the ceremony in protest of Trump's policies on immigration. A city councilman, Carrie Jang, said, quote, "The name Trump has now become synonymous not with luxury and lifestyle, but with racism, sexism, and intolerance," end quote. Jang is among other city officials boycotting the event. Vancouver's Trump International Hotel and Tower was built by developer Ju Kim Tia, the president and CEO of the Holborn Group. He is the son of one of Malaysia's wealthiest businessmen. The Trump Organization does not own the tower, but they licensed its name for branding and marketing.
In national news, big changes are being considered for Ontario's workplaces. Premier Kathleen Wynne's government is about to get advice that could lead to a significant shakeup of the laws governing work in Ontario. It could trigger the most significant reforms to the Employment Standards Act and the Labour Relations Act since Mike Harris was Premier. The Changing Workplaces Review is examining just about everything related to labour law in this province, including sick pay, overtime, how workers can join unions, and employers' responsibilities to contract workers. Quote, "The world of work that I went into as a young man is not the world of work that young people are going into today," end quote, said Labour Minister Kevin Flynn in an interview with CBC News. Quote, "We need to make sure that the regulations are protecting the most vulnerable," end quote. The review is focusing on the new realities of the millennial workforce, including the spread of part-time and contract work. Last July, the advisors laid out more than 200 options for reforms to protect vulnerable workers in precarious jobs. They included such ideas as requiring employers to give workers a minimum number of paid sick days and to give workers advance notice of their shift schedules. The final recommendations are due to being handed to Flynn in the coming days. Some of the options that the government's special advisors are considering include making sick days mandatory, boosting the minimum required paid vacation to 3 weeks per year from the current 2 weeks, requiring employers to pay their part-time workers the same as full-time workers doing similar jobs, forcing employers to post employees' schedules in advance, compensating workers for last-minute schedule changes, limiting the proportion of an employer's workforce that can be from temp agencies, banning or limiting the use of replacement workers during a strike, and making it easier for the employees of franchises to form unions. Facial recognition technology is coming to Canadian airports this spring. The technology is coming to major Canadian airports as a part of a new traveler screening program under development by Canada Border Services Agency. Facial recognition will be part of a new generation of self-service border kiosks that will compare travelers' faces with their passports. The kiosks are being pitched as part of a broader effort to modernize and streamline clearance procedures at Canadian airports, and will eventually replace the more limited kiosks currently in use. Quote, "The new kiosks will improve border security as well as assist in reducing wait times and congestion at Canada's busiest airports," end quote, a statement from the CBSA reads. The kiosks will begin appearing at Ottawa International Airport this spring, and the rollout will continue into 2018, CBSA says. The facial recognition feature appears to be similar to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's one-to-one facial comparison project, which uses facial recognition to compare a traveler's face with the image stored on their electronic passport. A Portuguese company called VisionBox is installing 130 kiosks at Toronto's Pearson International Airport. In an interview with CBC News, it offered a glimpse into how the new program will work. Quote, in terms of features to the benefit of CBSA, it's very much about biometrics, end quote, said Jean-François Lennon, the company's vice president of sales and business development. Privacy experts will be watching the program closely to ensure that the kiosk's facial recognition capabilities are being used as intended. Quote, the problem is going to be that once created, the capability is a general one that can be used in other contexts, said Tamir Israel, a staff lawyer with the Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic. Quote, and historically, once we have the technical capability, we haven't been very good at limiting it to that use, end quote. The kiosks are also expected to further decrease the number of traveler interviews with border agents at primary inspection, offloading much of that work to the new machines.
In international news, NASA has announced the discovery of 7 Earth-like planets orbiting a star just 40 light-years away. 3 of the planets are directly in the star's habitable zone, which means that water can most likely exist on the surface of them. Depending on the composition of their atmospheres, the other 4 could also have liquid water, the astronomers said. The exoplanets orbit a star in the constellation Aquarius, called TRAPPIST-1, which has a solar system very different from our own. TRAPPIST-1 is about a tenth of the mass of the Sun and about 1,000 as bright. Its low mass allows its planets to orbit very closely and remain in the habitable zone. The distance at which the planets orbit TRAPPIST-1 is comparable to the distance of Jupiter to its moons. All the planets are believed to be rocky and are all believed to be ground to be around the size of Earth, give or take 10 to 20%. Amaury Triaud, one of the paper's co-authors, said, quote, we can expect that in a few years we will know a lot more about these 7 planets, end quote. The European Parliament has voted to end visa-free travel for U.S. citizens within the EU. The move comes after the U.S. failed to agree visa-free travel for citizens of 5 EU countries, Bulgaria, Croatia, Cyprus, Poland, and Romania, as part of a reciprocity agreement. U.S. citizens can normally travel to all countries in the bloc without a visa. The vote urges the revocation of the scheme within 2 months, which means Americans will have to apply for extra documents for 12 months after the European Commission implements a delegated act to bring the change into effect. The Commission discovered 3 years ago that the U.S. was not meeting its obligations under the reciprocity agreement, but has not yet taken any legal action. The latest vote, prepared by the Civil Liberties Committee, approves a plenary session of Parliament and gives the Commission 2 months to act before MEPs can consider action in the European Court of Justice. Australia, Brunei, Japan, and Canada were also failing in their obligations, but all 4 have lifted or are soon to lift any visa restrictions on travel for EU citizens.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Ever hurt came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
All Access Pass is back for season 2. We are a collectively run weekly program that discusses equity, inclusion, and accessibility issues on and off UBC's campus, including both visible and invisible disabilities. You can catch All Access Pass every Thursdays from 2 to 3 p.m. Anyone can get involved. No experience is necessary. People of all abilities are welcome to join. Check us out on Facebook at All Access Pass or get involved by emailing accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Now, we have News 101 reporters Malone Mullen and Cal Murray's report on Vancouver's drug overdose crisis.
Limer Park, where people cluster around tables, marking names onto wooden feathers. But this is no arts and crafts affair.
Does everybody have a feather? Can the feather, people with the feathers hold them up, please? There are 914 feathers. That's one for every person that we've lost to overdose. We're going to carry them with us as we march down the street.
914 people dead of drug overdose in BC alone. Hundreds more dead across the country last year. It's a crisis that led activists to protest in 8 cities on Tuesday. Organizers call this the biggest mobilization for harm reduction Canada has ever seen.
When we march down the street today, we're gonna say, end the war on drugs. Because it's killing us. It's killing us one by one, and it's killing us as a whole. Because our whole community is suffering right now. But today is about turning that grief and that lack of power into action, into political action, and into demands that are a clear way forward to ending this crisis.
Many people here have been touched personally by unsafe drugs. Patrick Lal is one of them. He had to save his friend from a near-fatal overdose.
Most of my friends have been overdosing, so I got my Narcan training. I'm ready to save people's lives.
Have you actually ever saved somebody from an overdose?
Yeah, one of my friends. This was probably like last week. He overdosed. He needed about 3 vials of Narcan, and then the paramedics came and resuscitated him.
If you hadn't have been there, do you think that he would have died?
I think so, yeah. He would have. Because I was the one that administrated him the naloxone.
Naloxone reverses an overdose. It brings people back from the brink of death by blocking opioid receptors, but it must be injected quickly to save a life.
At work?
Yeah, at work. They found a needle in his arm and they didn't know what to do.
There was no one who had naloxone?
No one had naloxone training. No one knew how to give breaths to him, and he passed away.
Roving gangs of volunteers like Street Saviors and Spikes on Bikes find themselves patrolling East Vancouver's alleys with naloxone.
I've done 4 myself, 2 in the past month and 2 the previous month, and then the other team members, so we have about 9 on count now, and serious ones too. One took 7 ampules of naloxone to bring back and rescue breathing. There's with the carfentanil, it's a very scary situation right now.
Yeah.
It's creating a syndrome they're calling barrel chest syndrome, where their body, even if they want to breathe, they can't. It contracts, and our bag valve masks are very hard to get the oxygen going in them properly, so it requires a double intubation in the nose and stuff. And yeah, it's been scary down here.
Activists say naloxone can't solve the overdose crisis. At best, it's a band-aid fix. What Canada needs, they say, is regulated, safe drugs. Drugs that actually are what you think they are.
We know what will end this epidemic. Drug decriminalization. Full legalization and regulation of prohibited substances. Access to injectable opioids. Safe, unadulterated drugs. A place where people can use them. And support from our government to make sure that we have the ability to advocate for ourselves and for our human rights.
The crowd, 300 strong, marches to the city's main haven for harm reduction.
We're here at InSight, North America's first supervised consumption site. We are demanding from our federal government immediate exemption for all supervised consumption sites across the country. People are dying every day, every 6 hours, and in other provinces, every 12 hours. In Alberta, there's like 350 deaths already this year. Nobody should have to wait to use this service. No one should ever have to wait to use this service.
This service is a supervised consumption site where people can use drugs in a clean setting, with nurses waiting lest fentanyl strike. Nobody has ever died at InSight, a fixture of the neighborhood, in the 14 years it's been open. InSight has been so effective at preventing death and disease that nearly a dozen cities have applied to the federal government, wanting one of their own. But the process can take years. Health Minister Jane Philpott recently made it easier for these sites to gain federal approval, but users say it hasn't happened fast enough. To date, only Montreal has won the right to safe injection sites. The march stops next at Crosstown Clinic, where a lucky few get prescription heroin every day.
There's 150 people that are patients at Crosstown Clinic, and Crosstown Clinic is a sanctuary for those people. You ask any one of them and they'll tell you they might not be alive today if it hadn't been for the clinic. Today in Victoria, the government of British Columbia will announce that they have collected $2 billion more than they spent last year. Don't let them tell you they don't have the money to change things.
Now onward to our last stop, the St. Clair Centre in Health Canada.
At the Health Canada offices, activists implore government workers to meet their demands. I spoke to Jordan Westfall, one of the lead organizers of the protest, about the encounter.
Basically, a representative from Health Canada came out. He basically discussed our demands with them and our demand to speak with Health Minister Jane Philpott. Told them that we would be back and that there would be need for more actions and to relay the message to our health minister, Jane Philpott.
Did it sound positive?
No, he was scared to death. So right now, we don't know. It's up in the air. We have no assurances either way. But
have you ever spoken to Philpott?
Yeah.
I mean, she always talks about, you know, this is a priority for me. Do you believe her?
No, not at this point. I think they may have even made things worse by restricting prescription opioids. They saw it as a part of an issue, like a pharmaceutical issue, right? And they ignored the fact that it could increase overdose deaths. I think she wants to help, but at the same time, I don't know if she's going to be the one to push the change that we really need to see. But I hope she will be.
Others at the march share Jordan's skepticism, and for good reason. Vancouver police say fentanyl has been found in every illicit drug except cannabis, putting even recreational drug users at risk of overdose.
What do you think the current political barriers to it are? So why is there not a more swift response?
Well, it's obvious that there isn't the will to, you know, with everything that we have, the abundance of resources, money, know-how, we know what to do to end the drug war and to have people stop dying. There's just a lack of will.
Activists here know that legalization and regulation are the only real solutions. Laura Shaver, another organizer, sat down with Trudeau last month.
And he said, well, I've had hard enough time with the marijuana that I don't think I can take on the heroin. So thank you, buddy. For everybody here who's standing that's either lost somebody or is going to lose somebody, his shoulders are where most of our anger and our sadness should hang, because he is one of the people in Canada or the world that can change this for us, and he is not going to. So we need to do it ourselves.
They didn't need to have political bravery to say, go and do it. It's the right thing to do. Saving lives is always the right thing to do.
We march back to Oppenheimer, where the crowd disperses. They leave 914 feathers behind, tied to tree branches, dancing in the wind. Malone Mullen, Vancouver.
They'd hooked you up
to a fentanyl drip. To mitigate the pain a little bit, I flew in from Pennsylvania. When I heard the hour was coming fast, and I docked in Santa Barbara, tried to brace myself, but you can't brace yourself when the time comes. You just have to roll with the blast. And I'm an 18-wheeler headed down the interstate. And my brakes are...
...ordered Josh Gebert-Doyon's interview with Dr. Henry on Black History Month.
But first, we're going to take a quick PSA break. Stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Nice work, well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pick my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Now we have News 101 reporter Josh's interview with Dr. Henry on Black History Month.
February is Black History Month in Canada. CITR 101.9 FM hopes to do its part in celebrating Black history while aiming for more consistent and even representation of experiences often missing from the media narrative. To talk about how to make Black History Month beyond the month of February, we sat down with Dr. Annette Henry. Dr. Henry is a David Lamb Chair in Multicultural Education and is a professor at the Department of Language and Literacy Education at UBC. Her scholarly research investigates race, class, language, gender, and culture in sociocultural contexts of teaching and learning, particularly in the lives of Black students and Black women teachers. Her research scope includes Canada, the U.S., and the Caribbean. And her focus also includes feminism as well as conceptual and methodological research issues. Dr. Henry, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
So can you introduce your work a little bit for listeners? Tell us a little bit about your research interests.
Oh, yes. My research interests, as you read in the bio, I do qualitative research. I do narrative research. Right now I'm actually doing a big study of, so I have 90 audio tapes of life history interviews that were done about 10 years ago in Vancouver of Black people in Vancouver. And they were sitting on a shelf, so I'm working on that, and just I'm actually just digitizing them because they're on little microcassettes. But I mostly do life histories of Black women teachers. I'm very interested in what happens in classrooms with Black children in Canada and also in the U.S. and in the Caribbean, in Jamaica particularly. Also, although I have worked in Haiti, and I also. I'm very interested in feminist theory, so Black feminism, and applying feminist theory to thinking about teaching and learning in classrooms.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, to begin, Vancouver, like a lot of the Pacific Northwest, really has a very tenuous relationship to its own Black history. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the history of Hogan's Alley and figures like Joe Fortes, mm-hmm. Nora mm-hmm. Hendricks' tradition of Black entertainment that she was a part of. how do you doing this work now on interviews with about Black history? How do you think about Vancouver's specific Black history?
Yes, well, you know, Black history in you hit the nail on the head. Black history in Vancouver has been erased. Like it's not really celebrated, and people sort of look at me and like, huh, what are you doing? But we have a rich history since the 1850s, and you know, even James Douglas, the governor, was so-called mixed, right? On Salt Spring Island and so forth, and so we don't really have the numbers, for example, that one would find in a city like Toronto or Montreal. But we do have a Black presence, but we haven't really. It's not celebrated. It's not talked about very much. And there are some people doing the work, of course, as you mentioned, people like Wade Compton and the people in the Hogan's Alley Collective, for example. And I think I'm contributing with this group of people that I'm looking at. And actually, it was a Black women's organization, the National Council of Black Women, collected these interviews, and I think part of it was to keep the legacy going, to, you know, change the historical record, if you like, to revise the historical record. So I think that's my little part in Vancouver, and I think if we are a multicultural society, then we should really know about the various groups of people that live in British Columbia.
And tell me a little bit more about these interviews, if you're able to. Mm-hmm. So you procured them through this organization, and what exactly, who exactly is speaking on these interviews?
Okay, yeah. So we have people from like 28 to in their about 85 at the time. Some of them, a couple of them have since died. So some of them have been, well, people like Leon Bibb, you know, the famous folklorist and a singer, entertainer. Mm-hmm. He was one of them. So we have a lot of entertainers, actually, which I think says something about what Black people at a certain point in history could do and why they came to Vancouver. Entertainers, actors, singers, surgeons, lawyers, teachers, writers, professors. So it's I would say, quote-unquote, professional people. Mm-hmm. Those were the collection that was curated.
There's also something interesting about entertainment specifically as a kind of place of visibility maybe for the Black community. And you've written in the past about Canada in comparison to the U.S. and Canadian universities where race is talked about, or race rather isn't talked about, but diversity is made very public. I'm wondering what you think about Black History Month as a time where we talk or make certain things public.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of contradictory, and it's both at one and the same time, like just a wonderful, marvelous time, and a time where, you know, one has to say, you mean we only have 28 days mm-hmm. that we can celebrate ourselves? And many people have made the joke before that, you know, it's the coldest month of the year and it's the shortest month of the year, so let's just give that to Black people.
Right.
But given that it was meant to be transitional, that it was meant to be just a way of beginning to talk about Black history, so in 1926, when it was established in the U.S. as Negro History Week, it's now Black History Month, and some people call it African Heritage Month and different names. So it's a marvelous time because there's all kinds of interesting lectures and films and spectacular events, you know, and even in the popular media, things like I just saw Hidden Figures, for example, at the theater, and going to see James Baldwin's I Am Not Your Negro. So there's really lovely stuff out there mm-hmm. and lectures and talks. But it would be really nice if we didn't have to squish it all into one month. This is just normalized that, you know, that there's always amazing Black films available and always amazing lectures on Black life available. So that's the contradiction.
Right. And how do you think that we can kind of continue that practice into the rest of the year, the other 11 months. Where do you think, are there certain models for thinking about that, how we can continually reflect on Black history?
Yes, well, I think one thing that we can do, speaking of us at a university, is I think we can hire more Black professors. I think we can, you know, so that and teach, not that only Black people should be teaching about these things, but I think to change the conversation. The question is, how do we change the conversation? And I think if we have more racialized faculty, the conversations should change. So, and will change. I think that's mm-hmm. a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. In that same paper I mentioned before, which is titled "We Especially Welcome Applications from Members of Visible Minority Groups," mm-hmm. you take up specifically a subjective analysis, a sort of history yeah. of your own going through as a Black professor at three different universities. And I'm wondering how you think we can integrate that kind of lived experience to our understanding of Black History Month instead of falling back on this kind of safety net of, you know, objective, hard facts.
Yeah, it's I'm glad you read that paper. I actually have been very pleased with the feedback I've gotten on that because, you know, when you write a paper that's so subjective, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think still, though, the reactions to that paper have been interesting because I feel that it should create a dialogue amongst certain people, but it hasn't been able to, you know, and I think sometimes some people are very resistant to actually having these very nitty-gritty conversations, mm-hmm. although I have to admit that I found the students very open to the discussions, and I have hope there because I feel that the students are going to be the next generation of professors and professionals and people out there in the world, and so you know, they're the ones that I think we should be focusing on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this question of lived experience is really interesting to me, and I think that must also be applicable to these interviews and thinking about these interviews that you're working on now.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I started out my first, you know, research study, and part of my PhD dissertation was looking at the life histories of five Black women teachers and looking at their practices in their classroom and how their life experiences have informed their what they do in the classroom, because what they did in these classrooms with kids in, you know, I don't want to stereotype, but, you know, we have all these words like low-income, impoverished mm-hmm. area, but none of that they learned from teacher education, you know, so they learned it from their life experience, from understanding students from the Caribbean, students from low-income areas, and students who speak particular kinds of Creoles and so forth, and so so I think, interestingly, our life experiences inform our practice, whatever that practice is.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Black History Month means in Canada, a country, you know, which defines itself on a particular brand of multiculturalism?
Yeah, these are great questions. Well, I think, you know, we're newer to, I guess it's about 20 years since the Honorable Jean Augustine introduced Black History Month. But I think we've embraced it, but I still feel that there are, like, something that happened quite recently, one of my colleagues had said to me, until you came here, I'd never heard of Black History Month.
Hmm.
And this is a woman in her mid-50s. I was really surprised, and then I said to myself, well, I guess she wouldn't because she doesn't associate with any Black people, and maybe the kinds of people she, you know, in her circle just mm-hmm. wouldn't be even thinking of anything like this. And so also, as you mentioned, we pride ourselves in being this multicultural society where we tend not to sort of put emphasis on any one group. So we say, but that's not exactly true because mm-hmm. we do put emphasis basically. So you just have to, you know, look around, and the emphasis is on sort of Anglo conformity. So I think we're coming to Black History Month, and I know when I was a school teacher and I remember another teacher said, and this was years ago, who cares about Black History Month? And it was okay to say something like that then. But I think we've progressed, and people see, there's some important things to know, and we also have so many other months. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of crazy, you know. So we have, you know, Asian, you know, March and Women's History Month and this and that, and so everybody has their little months now.
Right, right. And is that going to be the extent of multiculturalism?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. That's kind of very, very, you know, liberal song and dance. You get your month, we'll keep you happy. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you get your month, and we'll keep you happy.
Right. You've also written on Stuart Hall, who I wanted to talk about briefly. Hall's written a lot about diasporic communities, and a lot of ways we can maybe think about Black History Month as a kind of time to maybe think about diaspora. And what sort of lessons do you think Stuart Hall can provide for thinking about Black History Month?
Yeah, well, Stuart Hall, I think, really understood diaspora, and he talked about the Caribbean as being the first diaspora and being the diaspora of a diaspora. So in many ways, and I suppose Pan-Africanism also gives us this sense of the interconnectedness and also understanding the specificities of, or understanding, I should say, how kind of global migrations have informed who we are and where we are in the world. So, I think he's been, you know, very important in thinking about blacks in Britain and definitely migrations. And one of the things that I came to understand in my paper about Stuart Hall as an educator was that he actually was an educator, like in schools. He worked in a comprehensive school, and so he was very involved in as an activist. While he was a substitute teacher, that was like something I'd never heard of before. Mm-hmm. So that sort of gave me another side to him as this amazing public intellectual and scholar, but also a real teacher in the true sense of the word.
I wanted to touch on, just before we finished up, about the Black radical tradition, which has been evoked and you know, taken up quite a bit over the past few years in relation to Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the value of studying this tradition is?
Well, I think it's important, and also to see its variegations. Like, I think one of the things that's important for us as Canadians too is to realize that this Black radical tradition is not just American, you know, that it is, we can say it's Pan-African, we can think of David Austin's work in the, as he looked at the unrest, let's just call it, in the 1960s, you know, when the Black students basically brought, you know, the university to a halt, and Sir George Williams University, now called Concordia, to a halt. And so the Black radical tradition has been here too. But then again, I think looking at the Black radical tradition, we see a couple of things. A, not much has really changed, because we're still thinking about and asking for equity. We're still talking about the overrepresentation of Black men in prison. We're still talking about overrepresentation of kids in special education, or kids not getting the education that they need. Even in Canada, where, you know, I think we think of these things very much in sort of impoverished areas in the United States, but no, we have these issues also in Canada, where, you know, there are schools in Toronto where 40% there are 40% dropout rates, and so. In my opinion, like, the kinds of things that people have been arguing for and fighting for and dying for, you know, are still prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, looking at Black Lives Matter, it's another iteration of saying we're not there yet, and we have to be vocal, or it doesn't seem we're going to be heard.
Absolutely. Dr. Henry, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Josh. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thank you, Josh.
Next up, we have Sydney Soldan's report on the official opening of the Trump Tower in Vancouver on Tuesday and the protests that erupted outside the building.
On Tuesday, February 28th, the Trump Tower officially opened on West Georgia Street in downtown Vancouver. In the wake of the election of U.S. President Donald Trump, several protests were planned to stand against his controversial policies. One protest took place in front of the tower all day, where hundreds of people gathered with anti-Trump signs while chants and live music broke out periodically. A heavy police presence was on hand to control the crowd. Trump's sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, along with his daughter Tiffany, were present for the opening. I spoke with attendees to hear their reasons for protesting.
So why did you come up today?
Well, I live just down the street, so I have to pass this building often, and I have found myself recently going on either side of this street, so I don't have to look at that because it upsets me. I think it's because of the Trump values. It doesn't seem to belong in Canada, and I don't like to think about it. There's nothing as a Canadian that I can do. I wasn't able to vote. I couldn't make any difference. But to come down here, this is the difference that I'm making.
I'm here because the Trump values, and I totally agree, the Trump values are not our values. And I am appalled that someone like Donald Trump is elected the leader of the free world. It just curls my hair. And I'm also here because I object, as a Vancouver taxpayer, I object to paying to protect the sons who are here in a business capacity. I understand the Secret Service has to protect the American president's family. That's okay. But damn it, they're here for business.
I think it's important for Canadians to show that we're welcoming for anybody fleeing the violence and oppression facing so many Americans today, notably Muslims, Latinos, and other oppressed groups. And Canada has a long tradition from the Underground Railroad to taking in draft dodgers, taking in Americans that are fleeing violence, often perpetrated by their own government. And I think it's really important now to continue that tradition and to take in those people fleeing the proto-fascist regime that we see under Donald Trump.
Why are you here today?
Well, you know, I'm always standing in solidarity with our First Nations dream, which is our ancestors set a dream out thousands of years ago for all the nations to return here. So everything that this name stands for stands in opposition to what I believe in, which is cooperation, unity, peace, love, you know, a future for our children, looking after our resources, not exploiting them, becoming conscious human beings. And I thought, you know, the Trump name to me is just, it's self-evident. You know, it's a name of ego, a man who's gone insane with greed and power. And, you know, I'm just stunned. But, I mean, I'm stunned, but I'm not fooled and I'm not surprised. And I keep saying to people, like, even when it all dies down, just keep coming out, write the messages across, and especially in the summer with chalk, because, you know, like, oh, well, you know, what's the use? You know, they'll just wash it away. I'm like, yeah, but they will have to come out and with their buckets or their hoses, and they'll have to wash it away.
Exactly.
And we just keep that stream of that consciousness. And there are some people say, well, there's not, you know, there's only so many people here. But it's not about the number. It's about the power that you're bringing.
Oh,
Thank you, Sydney. That's our program for March 3rd. We would like to remind our listeners that CITR's annual fund drive will be in full swing next week. Our wonderful volunteers will take your phone calls and donation information from Thursday, March 9 at noon till Thursday, March 16 at 9:30 p.m. Please call us at 604-822-8648. Today's newscast was brought to you by our talented volunteers. If you would like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news/101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and Mixcloud pages. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Today's broadcast was produced by Sahar Asaf and Andrew Seal. From the entire team at CITR, thank you for listening.